Welcome to the Canteen Podcast, a show for anyone who has feelings about food. Join host Ali Houston as guests open up about their relationship with food and their thoughts on nutrition. Nourish yourself with the Canteen Podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of the Canteen Podcast. I'm your host Ali Houston. My guest today is Tucker Goodrich. If you listen to this episode and still want to eat vegetable oil, you might want your head looked at. I hope you enjoy. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts, hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. Paleocanteen.co.uk is the UK's one-stop paleo and low-carb food provider, where you can get restaurant-quality meals, grass-fed Scottish beef and lamb, outdoor-bred pork, and a selection of paleo and low-carb products, delivered chilled to your door. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Thanks, and enjoy the show. Here we are, we're live, and we've got Tucker Goodrich. Tucker is a Wall Street risk specialist and tech guru. He's a blogger on barefoot style running and healthy diets, and he's described how he's fixed his own severe health problems by changing his diet. His focus on a particular type of fat as a potential cause of modern chronic diseases has brought him notable followers and the attention of skeptics alike. Formerly known as Mr. Whole Wheat, he has also changed his opinion on that subject. Welcome.
Nice to be here, guys. Ali and John, good to meet you. Yeah, thank you for having me on.
You too. No, thanks very much for coming on.
You had to bring up the Mr. Whole Wheat thing, huh?
Yeah, I mean, maybe you could start by just telling us about Mr. Whole Wheat and how that changed.
Yeah, so I grew up with a mother who had a weight problem, who was always doing diets and Weight Watchers and all this stuff. So I early on learned a great distrust for the whole diet enterprise. So I basically, you know, but I mean, obviously, junk food is bad for you. I had a lot of dental problems when I was a kid, and I took a dentist's advice when I was 18 or 19 and stopped eating sugar, which solved all my dental problems. So I was, you know, I realized that a good diet is important for health. The question was, what's a good diet? So I basically went with the, you know, the recommendations here in the US, the food pyramid, which means, you know, salads, whole wheat. I used to joke with my kids that I was Mr. Whole Wheat because I was trying to get them to eat whole grains. I'd eat whole grain pasta and, you know, lots of oatmeal and everything else that you were supposed to do. And nevertheless, had a bunch of health issues. When I turned 38, I came down with what was initially diagnosed as a stroke, and I spent 4 days in a stroke ward being poked at by medical students who thought I was fascinating because they told me, we never get anybody your age in here. You're so interesting. And I'm like, get away from me. Really not what you want to hear when you're in the hospital.
Yeah.
And 2 years later, I came down with acute diverticulitis, which is diverticular little pouches that form in your colon. Some debate over what causes them to form. But once they get a perforation, it becomes acute diverticulitis. And what a perforation means is that the contents of your bowel, your feces, to be polite about it, are leaking into your abdomen. And your colon doesn't like having a hole in it, and it's rather unbelievably painful. So that got me into the hospital for another 4 days, and then, you know, a nice IV feed of antibiotics until that healed up and the inflammation went down. And then probably about 6 months later, a colon resection, which means they had to chop 8 inches of my colon out.
And this was all in your late 20s, did you say?
30s. So yeah, the stroke was at 38. The colon resection was at 40.
Right.
Oh, and that was a classic because, you know, I'm in the hospital. It's like a week or two after my 40th birthday. And I go look up acute diverticulitis, and whatever webpage I looked at says typically happens in people over 40 years old. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. I just turned 40. But what I realized when I was in the hospital was that I had had a previous attack when I was in my 20s. And you don't mistake this for anything else. It's incredibly painful. You come down with a fever. You start bleeding out your rectum. You can't eat. So both times I didn't eat for 4 days and lost like 10, 15 pounds. And, you know, the bleeding out the rectum thing definitely gets your attention when you're sitting on the toilet.
Yeah.
As you would imagine. So yeah, it started when I was in my 20s. I didn't go to the hospital the first time around, so it didn't get diagnosed. But after the first time, I came down with chronic diarrhea that lasted for the 14 subsequent years, which meant that whenever I traveled, and I mean, I was pretty active, you know, I was skiing and mountain biking and whitewater kayaking, and it meant that whenever I traveled, I had to bring a backpack with a roll of toilet paper along, just because, you know, I might need it at a moment's notice, which is not fun. So 2 years after the colon resection, and I had a bunch of other health issues that I didn't really connect with that at that point. I had, round about the same period, I'd broken about six bones over 2 years, toes, fingers, ribs, doing various things that I've since come to realize is probably borderline osteoporosis. I was having all sorts of autoimmune issues, you know, which I'd had my whole life, asthma and allergies.
But apart from that, you were fine.
No, and I thought I was quite healthy. And I thought I was just, you know, getting older. I distinctly remember looking in the mirror one day in the winter and looking at myself and thinking, God, you're looking old. You know, and that was 12 years ago, and I look younger now. So I don't have a beard, but anyway, so then 2 years after that, 2 years after the colon resection, I got into this barefoot running thing that you mentioned, and a friend that I made in that movement sent me a link to this somewhat bizarre blogger named Stefan Guionet, who is also into barefooting and was a PhD student in nutrition, as I recall, and neuroscience at the time. So I started reading. He did this amazing blog post. He was at that point looking into the scientific support for Weston Price's book, right? Mm-hmm. Weston Price makes a bunch of claims, and Stefan was going through the scientific literature.
I'm sorry, you know, I should say, for those who are listening who don't know, Weston Price was a dentist in the early 20th century who traveled around the world because he was, you know, he had the money and the leisure time, and he kind of tracked the health of traditional peoples. And he noticed some remarkable things, like the rate of dental decay was, you know, like 1 in 1,000 teeth or something like that, which, you know, for groups of people who were living primitively, in quotes, you know, they had very robust health. There was no obesity. That some tribes didn't know what he meant by heart disease and cancer and so on.
Right.
So he was one of the first people to really get people thinking about, you know, how diet and environment anyway can profoundly affect health. And I think you were talking about Stefan Guionet, who had written about that person.
Right. And beyond what you said, it's important to understand Price was one of the leading scientists of his age. He was the head of scientific inquiry at the American Dental Association. So he was a leading scientist in the United States, you know. He was also a dentist, but it's not fair to just qualify him as that because, you know, when he wrote his book, which was titled Nutrition and Physical Degeneration, the introduction was written by the head of anthropology at Harvard, who commented on how brilliant it was that Price decided to look into health issues by going and finding people who are healthy and saying, what are they doing that's different from what we're doing? And it's an approach that medicine has never really taken up, amazingly. So anyway, Stefan did this post about dental health, and what it made perfectly clear is that it was good dental health is 100% the result of your diet. There's virtually no genetic component to it. And as somebody who had 8 teeth pulled and countless cavities growing up and attributed it to bad genes, because my mother and my grandmother both had bad teeth, I was blown away, right? You know, and very upset, because I hate going to the dentist. And the fact that, you know, all that stuff I had to go through as a kid was optional or a mistake, however you want to look at it, was pretty upsetting. So I started reading Stefan's blog, and he started talking about, his two big themes at the time were seed oils and wheat. And I found his seed oil stuff pretty interesting. I thought his wheat stuff was kind of crazy because, you know, I was Mr. Whole Wheat and I ate lots of wheat and I was healthy, you know, and I was active. So I kind of discounted that, but I read it all and I checked all of his footnotes and read all the studies he looked at because I'm skeptical and don't take anybody at their word, right? I trust but verify. But he also went on a lot about seed oils a lot. So one day I was in the cafeteria at work and I, you know, was getting myself a salad, and I got to the end of the salad bar and I looked at the squeeze bottles of salad dressings. And I thought to myself, these have got to be, based on the quality of the cafeteria, these have got to be the cheapest oils known to man. What happens if I just stop eating them? Right? Let's start now. So I put some vinegar, salt, and pepper on the salad, skipped the salad dressing, and a couple of days later, my 14 years of chronic diarrhea came to an end.
No way.
Which absolutely blew my mind. And I've gone back, and Stefan was great. He was very, you know, supportive and helpful in answering my questions. And I've gone back and reread the email that I sent to him, and I was just astonished. I was like, you know, at that point, it had been 16 years of, you know, irritable bowel syndrome, whatever you want to call it. And the fact that it resolved that quickly blew my mind. So the other interesting thing that happened was my carbohydrate cravings went away. I had tried to go low carb before and couldn't get around carbohydrate cravings. And I basically forgot to eat any carbs for a week. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the next week, I had a sandwich on whole wheat bread, of course, and discovered that I was phenomenally gluten intolerant, despite being Mr. Whole Wheat.
Because by accident, you'd stopped eating wheat. And because of the lack of a desire for carbohydrates that came on suddenly, yeah. And then so a week later, you thought, oh, I'll have a pastrami on rye or whatever. And then...
roast beef and Swiss, actually, yeah.
Right, but, okay.
So I, you know, went down and had a horrible reaction to it. And at that point, you know, having read all of Stephen's stuff, I was cognizant that this was a possibility.
Yeah.
And so this time I intentionally did an experiment and didn't eat any, you know, wheat for the following week, and then had a couple of slices of pizza and thought I was having a heart attack from the reaction I had. So that was, now subsequently it turned out that the stroke symptoms were from wheat consumption. And the doctor, with some assistance from me, changed my diagnosis from a stroke to a migraine. And, then I had another migraine a while later, which confirmed the change diagnosis. And what I've since realized is that every single time I've had those stroke-like symptoms, the migraine attack, it's been after I eat some gluten inadvertently or some wheat inadvertently. You know, so that's pretty, including my favorite, the gluten-free pasta that my wife had picked up, my ex-wife now had picked up at the supermarket. And, you know, I had this horrible reaction, couldn't see. So when I say stroke, I mean, I would lose about 30% of my vision. I wasn't able to speak. More recent times, I've lost the ability to talk and to recognize faces, which is there. The inability to speak is called aphasia, receptive and expressive aphasia. I can't remember the term for not being able to recognize faces, but...
That must be quite disconcerting. Or is it? Do you not really realize it's happening at the time?
Well, it came on later in the attack, but it was interesting because I was watching a television show that I watch regularly, mm-hmm. and I didn't recognize any of the people on the television show.
Wow.
And they're all the same characters. I mean, I could see them, but, you know, that little part of your brain that says, oh, that face is... It was Supergirl, actually. And the little part of my brain that says, oh, that face is Supergirl, and that's Jimmy Olsen, just didn't work.
That's so strange.
Like, I saw these faces up there, and there was just no connection. It was like I'd never seen them before.
Wow. I mean, I know I've had a sort of slightly similar thing when I lived in China for a year and then came back, and I'd really got used to seeing Chinese people because it's a very mono
culture. There's a lot of Chinese culture. People in China.
There's a lot of them, yeah. And I nearly stopped someone in the street because I thought it was a friend of mine. And it was I got right up to them and I was about to say hello, and I just realized it was some guy. Yeah, because I'd unlearned to distinguish white faces. But obviously it's a different thing, you know. I mean, I've had problems with migraines, but I don't think I was having a migraine at the time. Who knows?
Well, that would make sense, because, I mean, if you don't use a language for a while, the ability goes away.
Yeah, it's so, more of that sort of thing, getting rusty at right. it. But, I mean, that's an amazing story. And it's kind of, it feeds into what Weston Price found, really. I mean, he did some pretty good kind of cataloging of what he found, but it was reportage, you know, it's a collection of anecdotes about people's health. And
it's a little better than anecdotes, but, you know, because he does actually go measure people's teeth and he takes pictures of their faces and he measures the malocclusion was a big point of his, you know, where your teeth come in crooked or they can't, there isn't enough room for them all to come in.
That's so he did get a common thing, isn't it, in the West, that people have to have teeth pulled and you think right. it's just standard practice, but and we sort of lament for the people in previous generations who didn't have access to good dentistry. But it was more than likely just their environmental conditions and the food they were eating that was causing that to happen.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, a lot of the people Price looked at didn't need dentists because they had perfect teeth and they had no cavities.
Yep.
So, you know.
Yeah, so what I was kind of coming around the houses to say is that you're big into the power of an anecdote to spark a scientific discussion and to spark scientific inquiry. And yours is very strong in that regard.
Yeah, so basically, you know, all this stuff happened to me that shouldn't have happened, according to what I knew when I started out on this, right? Other than Stefan's blog and the papers that I read, you know, if you went and talked to a doctor, he would tell you, I remember when I decided to change my diet, after stopping eating vegetable oils. And then I started, you know, realizing that I had to learn something about how to eat, which was a surprise, that I needed to do that. And I went to my doctor at the time who'd been seeing quite a lot of me. And I said, you know, I think I'm going to change my diet and go on this high fat diet. He said, I'm really concerned. And, you know, I don't think that's healthy at all. And, you know, given your health conditions, you've got high cholesterol, you're pre-diabetic. And I said, well, that's why I'm here, doc. I want you to, you know, I want to do the tests. And if I'm killing myself, I want you to tell me. And he was like, okay, that's fair. But yeah, the power of the experience. I mean, you know, the anecdote thing, especially physicians use that pejoratively, right, to deprecate somebody's story. But the thing to remember about science is essentially all anecdotes, right? every scientific paper you read is somebody's story about some experiment or observation he did with a layer of practice around it to make it reputable, mm-hmm. right? But anything can be reputable. I mean, if you know John and you know John's really thoughtful and careful observer of things, and John comes back and tells you a story, you're going to value that more highly than, you know, if your kooky acquaintance who is into all sorts of, you know, witchcraft and whatever else comes back and tells you that, you know, this crystal that he found on the street saved his life, right? There's a level of evidence there. Yep. And everybody does that. And scientists do that. Yep. You know, good scientists listen to people's stories, right? Because that's where they get the ideas to do experiments.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a story that it's ironic, rather. There's a quote that doctors always use. The plural of anecdote is not data. And it's ironic because it's a misquote. The actual quote is from a Nobel Prize winning economist. And it's the actual quote is the plural of anecdote is data. Mm-hmm. Right? Because if somebody tells you a story, okay, maybe it could be wrong. If a million people tell you the same story, then you got to start coming up with why are a million people thinking this is happening, right? Yeah. What's behind it? There's got to be something going on here. And that's how you, you know, which is not to say believe every anecdote you hear, but you've got to be thoughtful about it and critical about it at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, there's that terrific British Medical Journal small article, which catalogues the number of randomized controlled trials to test parachutes.
So right.
It describes how many times they've thrown people out of planes, half of them with parachutes and half of them without. And surprise, surprise, there's none.
Well, they didn't have, some wise guys actually went and did an RCT of parachutes after, in response to that. But the trial failed because they couldn't get any volunteers to jump out of the parachute, right? Because the power of anecdote is too strong, right?
Yeah.
You don't, you know, I mean, the parachute was invented by a scientist and he did experiments with animals, but he didn't do an RCT throwing people out of a building without a parachute.
Yeah.
And none of us have ever seen a study on parachutes or guns or lots of other things that we know are dangerous because of anecdotes.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's a really powerful effect, you don't need to randomize, right? Nobody needs to randomize to know that if they stick a gun to their head and pull the trigger, they're going to get a bad outcome.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I studied physics and
right, yeah.
That there's some finite probability that if you put a gun to your head and fire it, then it won't kill you.
Might get a misfire.
Yeah. You might even disappear and reappear on Mars. You know, there's some
finite quantum effect
that could happen, but it's, you know, infinitesimal and common sense is often all you need.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, going back to your story, where have you gone since then in terms of the sort of dive into food? As far as you were concerned, your health problems more or less started healing then and didn't stop healing. But
yeah,
what else have you done?
Problems that
then? How would you describe your kind of scientific investigations since then?
Well, so professionally, I'm a self-taught software and systems engineer. And I did that by digging down into things that I didn't know and making myself an expert at them. And this was just so fascinating and so contra to what I was expecting that I just got super curious about what was going on. I also realized simultaneously the power of the power of a healthy diet. And so for instance, my older daughter was having trouble in math and the school had thought that she might need to go, she might need to be diagnosed for ADD, right? So after I changed my diet and we started, you know, my ex-wife started seeing the effect it had on my health, we decided that we should do the same thing for the whole family. And about a month later, you know, so we did the classic, throwing all the junk food out of the pantries, right? Buying healthy food, figuring out what healthy food meant and buying it. And, about a month later, you know, that we went gluten free, we went seed oil free. About a month later, the math tutor calls up and she says, "Has something changed with your daughter?" And my ex was like, "What are you talking about?" She said, "Well, she's so much more focused. She just got through 6 pages of math problems in the time it usually takes her to get through 1 page of math problems." And we were like, "Wow, that's, well, you know, yeah, we changed our diet a month ago, but that couldn't have anything to do with it." Well, it turns out, you know, if you talk to Dr. Alessio Fasano, who's the leading expert in gluten problems and celiac disease, he sees that all the time, that kids who've got attention deficit disorder, when they go on a gluten-free diet, you know,
yeah,
get a lot better.
So, Dr. Reichelt as well is another one who's done a lot of work on that. And casein as well is something that he advises to get rid of. The evidence is difficult to parse because it's one of those things where you can't really do randomized controlled trials, you know? So I think what happens in the end is...
Well, but you can do, I mean, there are other ways to get to the same level of certainty, right? I mean, what I did with myself, since I can't randomize myself, you do challenge. Well, if you're already eating something, you do withdrawal, challenge, back
absolutely.
And forth.
And it's what I did. And yeah. I was able to switch my symptoms on and off, including diagnosed ADHD. And
oh, really?
Yeah. I was diagnosed by a psychiatrist in Glasgow with ADHD. And, you know, I was really struggling with focus. And it, when I changed my diet, it was just like the planets aligned and I was able to focus on whatever I felt like focusing on. And I had control again. It was remarkable. It wasn't just that sort of, I wasn't at the mercy of something that I didn't understand. It was great. Right. So, I mean, it totally changed my life in that regard. And I did tests to make sure that I could bring it back. So there was various foods that did that. And, you know, I guess the difficult thing for some people to grasp hold of, including me when I was looking for evidence that it might be an effective way of doing things, is that you have all sorts of confounding factors. You know, people, Reichelt talks about kids not being able to find out if they can be helped in their health problems by changing their diet, because quite often it's someone at school or it's a grandparent is secretly feeding them biscuits because they think it's cruel to not do so. They're missing out. Or the kid themselves, you know, they don't know that this could actually really change their, they don't have the impulse control to stop themselves if something comes up like that and they're able to eat it. So it's just difficult to reach a critical mass of that kind of general understanding that these things can help so powerfully. But I think it is moving in that direction because the plural of anecdote is clearly data. You know, if there's a mass of people saying to try something, then people will try it. And
well, and especially, I was talking to some people just the other day, and they said, "Oh, you know, I described how I ate," and they were like, "Oh, is that keto?" And I was like, "Yeah." And they were like, "Oh, our friend is on keto. He lost 45 pounds. He feels great. He looks great." Well, bingo, anecdote, right? Yeah. They now have multiple anecdotes telling them the same thing, and now it's on their radar. Because that was what happened to me in my office. I also, by the way, I mean, I wasn't very overweight, but I was, you know, 20 odd pounds overweight, and it just fell off in 2 months. And I got a glow around my face and I started getting carded at bars again, which is nice. And, you know, everybody at the office is like, asking me, "What are you doing? You look so much better. You look so different." right? So people see that and they notice, you know, because everybody's going through the same thing. Everybody's got weight problems pretty much. I mean, you know, unless they're eating this way, mm-hmm. Everybody's yeah. going through this and everybody wants a solution.
And it was interesting, my experience of trying to find a doctor who understood what I was going through and understood that I actually completely turned everything around by changing the way I ate. My doctor at the time was not very understanding, didn't think that the diet could be cause of my health turning around in a positive way. And I think that doctor at the time falls into a category of scientists who are skeptical beyond what is reasonable and
are dismissive.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I'm not trying to bash doctors or anything. They've got like 4 minutes per patient over here sometimes. And depending on what postcode they're living in or they're working in. And, you know, people do come to them all the time with crank theories, but yeah. I also think that my pet theory about that is that these particular dismissive skeptics have never struggled with their weight or their health in a way that diet can explain.
But that's not even, I don't even know that that's fair. I mean, I know Trokalagian, who's yep. a doctor on Twitter, we're all yep. fond of. He's a little bit of a character. And he lost 160 pounds. I think he was at like 300 odd pounds for a good part of his life. And he obviously had a weight problem. Yeah. And he was skeptical about it because nothing worked. Mm-hmm. Right? The advice didn't work. Yeah. And that's why the patients are skeptical about it. And that's why I was skeptical about it, because I watched my mother go through Weight Watchers and her weight cycle up and down and nothing worked.
Right? Yeah.
Well, I've been weight stable now for almost 10 years. I've counted calories for a single day out of those 10 years just as an experiment. And it was horrible. I will never do it again.
Yeah. I'm in the same boat.
Huh?
I'm in the same camp. Yeah.
This works. And people, you know, my doctor, the doctor who is, you know, I went in to do the testing. You know, he was a really good guy. I was lucky because I've gone through some other guys after him who were just idiots. But he was a good guy. He was open-minded. He was willing to talk to me. He'd learned through my health problems that, you know, as I was saying before, he'd learned that I was a careful observer. And when I called him up and told him something was off, so for instance, I told him I was having a heart problem at one point, right? That yeah. it felt like I had an irregular heartbeat. So I went into his office, he put me on an EKG. He's like, no, it's perfectly normal. I was like, well, you know, it happened after I ran up the stairs at work. So let me go run up and down the stairs and then plug me back in the EKG. So I go with the wires hanging off my chest, run up and down the stairs. He plugs me back in and he's like, there you go. Now you have an irregular heartbeat. Mm-hmm. So I earned credibility, right, through stuff like that. My father now sees him. My father had a heart attack last year, which is kind of another long story. So one of the visits, my father, you know, my father's in his late 80s, so I go to his doctor's appointments with him now, and he asked the doctor, you know, my old doctor, you know, so what should I eat? And his doctor said, you should do whatever your son tells you to do. That was the end of that diet conversation. And as part of that conversation, it turned out that my father was basically diabetic. And, you know, the physician said to me, he said, well, you know, at this level of diabetes, he had an A1C of 6.4, which is, you know, 0.1 below diabetes.
Okay.
On the verge of needing his foot cut off, but not technically diabetic. And the doctor said, you know, it's really tough for us to treat diabetes at this level. And I said to him, diabetes is easy. Just watch. I said, we will have his HbA1c down to normal in a couple of months. Not a problem. A couple of months go by. HbA1c is the same level as the doctor's, right? 5.6, high normal.
Yeah.
Next time I see the doctor, so I'm on a low-carb diet. I've lost 5 pounds. I couldn't believe it.
That's fantastic. And it's a nice story because it doesn't always go like that. And there are people out there who remain skeptical and I guess me trying to work out their motives might not be that productive, but it's a drive I have because I want to understand, you know, why it's troubling for some people that so many people are finding this helps. You know, it doesn't make sense to me.
A lot of it's that they think it's, you know, okay, so we shouldn't psychoanalyze physicians, but having said that, my thought is that medical school selects for good students, right? They don't select for, and it's sensible, they don't select for people who question the system.
Yeah.
They are there to train people to go out and reliably implement what they think is right. And they're not looking for some guy like me who's going to question and challenge everything.
Yeah, the maverick.
Right. So mavericks, there are some mavericks who make it through medical school. A lot of them, it seems like Dr. Eads tend to have a medical or an engineering background because they're mm-hmm. trained in a different, more rigorous style of thinking than doctors are, which is basically, you know, doctors are trained to memorize.
And I should say for people who don't know who Dr. Eads is, that's Mike Eads, who wrote the book with his wife, who's also a doctor, called Protein Power. In the 80s or early 90s, and it's in the 90s, and it's a million seller, and it's kind of would it be fair to say that it's a version of Atkins, sort of low carb type?
I think it'd be more than fair to say it's yes. spot on. He was also one of the guys who originally came up with the whole paleo diet idea,
mm-hmm.
way back when he was, you know, before he wrote that book, he wanted to put a chapter on Paleolithic eating in, and his editors wouldn't let him.
Yeah,
super sharp guy.
And great that he said, okay, well, let's actually get the evidence for this. I can see it works, but let's turn this into credible evidence. And remarkable that, you know, a lot of these really robust studies were done a long time ago, and people still are kind of dragging their heels to accept that.
Well, and that's another problem with medical training is. And another problem with good students, I mean, I'm an autodidact, right? I'm self-taught at my profession. So I'm really good at doing research. And I'm really good at doing research and I'm good at doing research with a gun to my head and coming to a correct conclusion, because otherwise the gun's going to come off, right? That's the environment I worked in for 20 years in Wall Street, where if something breaks, you're going to lose a lot of money if you don't fix it fast. So you have to fix it fast. There's no other option. So I'm really good at going out and doing research and figuring stuff out. And physicians generally don't think that way, right? They ask a colleague, the colleague tells them some plausible sounding story and they go with it. Or they look in their textbook or they look in the literature. And if you've got, you know, like diabetes care, what the literature says to do for diabetes care is wrong, but none of them know it.
Yep.
Because they're just trained to go follow the guidelines, follow the protocol, follow the professor, right?
And you can understand the motivation for that, because if someone, you know, were to just decide to go off piste, then it could be someone who's a bad actor, someone who's actually got bad motives. And so,
I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm saying it explains their behavior.
Yes.
Right. And as a patient, you need to understand their behavior.
Yeah.
Because you need to understand what, you know, they're motivated by and what the quality of the advice you're going to get from them is. Right. Just like if you go to a car mechanic and he tells you to put water in your gas tank, you're going to tell him to go bugger off because, you know, it's stupid.
Yeah.
Well, if you're a diabetic and your doctor tells you you should be eating lots of carbohydrates and shooting up with insulin, that's just as stupid.
Yeah.
Right. Yet that's the standard of care. And you need to understand why that's the case. Now, Eads, so what I find is, you know, I had a conversation on Twitter with a bunch of doctors and scientists. And one of them said, well, there's no evidence, you know, we don't have robust evidence that low carb diets are safe. And I said, you're kidding me, right? She said, no, we need good evidence. And I said, okay, Dr. Atkins' book was not only the best-selling diet book ever, it was one of the best-selling books. I think it was in the top 50 best-selling books in the English language ever in history, right? So millions and millions of people bought his book and tried his diet. Then there are a couple of companies, the protein sparing modified fast companies, like Optifast and Metafast. Mm-hmm. They're big companies. They're public companies.
Yeah.
It's a keto diet. I mean, if you go on their website, you know, because my ex-wife decided to go on one of these at one point, so I went and researched it. It's a ketogenic diet. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Millions of people have gone on these things. Go look through the literature, right? I mean, if you have untold millions of people on a diet, this is the flip side of the anecdote story. Millions of people on this diet, go look through the literature. How many bad outcomes can you find in the literature? A handful.
Yeah.
And in what respect are they concerned about the safety exactly of the low-fat diet, of the low-carb diet?
Because they were told all through their training that saturated fat is bad for you and causes heart attacks and is going to kill you, right?
Yep.
So they don't want to prescribe something, to their credit, they don't want to prescribe something to their patients that they were told in medical school is going to kill them, right? God bless them for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just happens to be wrong. So, yeah, I don't know. So, yeah, it's, you know, it's important to understand the, you know, and that said, not to be too rough. So back to Tro was.
He's going to come on to the podcast, by the way.
Beg your pardon?
He's going to come on to the podcast soon, Tro.
That's great. He's an excellent guy. He's an excellent guy. I like him a lot. He and I drove down to Philadelphia together to go see. The Magic Bullet. They did a premiere down in Philadelphia with a couple other doctors. So we drove down there for that.
He's Magic Pill?
Guy. Huh?
The Magic Pill?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what did I say? The Magic Bullet? The Magic Pill. That's right. Mm-hmm. So he was super skeptical about all this stuff, right? Yep. And he and I and Dr. Baker, we used to have some epic battles on Twitter arguing about this stuff. But he was open-minded. And he was willing to be corrected, right? He was willing to learn. And then he started trying all this stuff and it worked for him. And now he's got an obesity clinic that he just opened up. And this is his practice now, is doing all this stuff, a lot of which he learned about on Twitter. It's amazing. It's
and
a
he
great
looks,
story
he, look, he looks ripped. I mean, he goes to the gym a lot, but he's a big lad now in a good way.
Yeah. No, and looking at him, you would never guess he was over 300 pounds a couple of years ago.
No, it's an amazing story. It's great. It's just one of so many. So kind of going back to like you and your relationship with food, just to personalize it more, what's your earliest food memory?
Oh, God.
Where are you from exactly?
I was born in New York City and grew up in Connecticut for the most part.
Oh yeah,
which is a suburb of New York.
I've been to the States a few times. I actually lived there when I was six. It was my whole family moved over. It wasn't just us, me, a six-year-old with a briefcase and a dream. It was we moved to Iowa for.
That must have been interesting.
For 6 months, yeah. But my dad didn't really like the job, so we moved back to Scotland. I was nearly an Iowan, but
I was going to say, I can hear from your accent that no permanent damage was done.
I was after apparently 6 weeks. I was mommy, but it didn't stick around. I've never been to the East Coast.
It's East Coast is nice. The fewer tornadoes.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think I've ever actually been to Iowa or not spent any time there. But the Midwest is a lot different. Big sky country out there. Very flat. Mm-hmm. Here it's very hilly and lots of trees. More like England. Hence, you know, they call it New England. So what was it? Oh, food memory. I'm laughing about that because my mother has a whole series of stories she tells me about when I was a toddler. And what did I eat? I ate some mushrooms I picked from under the house.
oh dear.
I ate a glass Christmas tree bulb. So well. And I apparently drank water off the top of the garbage can lid. pediatrician to say, that's disgusting. And then my mother said, so do I need to take him to the emergency room? And he said, no, you know what? I mean, dogs drink that stuff all the time and they're fine. He'll probably be okay. So food memories, I don't know. I was a huge fan of clams on the half shell, which I would eat by the dozen, and mashed potatoes growing up. I think mashed potatoes were my favorite food when I was growing up.
Yeah.
And then eating sugar by the spoonful.
I remember putting sugar on my cereal, which was already sugary. I was a total fiend, and I would probably have that 3 times a day, as well as all the other food. Who was the cook in your house growing up?
Who did the cooking in the house?
Yeah.
My mother, and she was, you know, pretty old school, you know, meat and vegetables and sit at the table until you finished your vegetables. God, I remember the first time I encountered Brussels sprouts, which I now like. I think I sat there for 4 hours before I finally choked them down.
You know, like them, yeah?
Yeah, I've come around. I mean, if they're, you know, roasted, Brussels sprouts are delicious. I think she was boiling them or steaming them or something, and they were pretty god-awful.
Yeah. Seems a whole generation of people decided to boil the shit out of vegetables and put the next generation off them entirely.
Well, we're, you know, English and Irish. There's a dish in New England called the New England boiled dinner, and everything is boiled, and there are no spices added. Salt and pepper, and that's it.
The Puritan way.
It's just about as appetizing as it sounds.
And what's kind of your food heaven now? I mean, is it just Brussels sprouts all the way, or is it?
No, I've been, you know, I'm pretty simple. Just meat, eggs, seafood, some fruit, some vegetables. I've kind of flirted with the carnivore thing, but, you know, I don't have all my health issues are long resolved. And since I know what the triggers were, I just avoid those, and I'm pretty much fine. I did move down to Texas for a year, and my beef consumption went way up. So I noticed that things seem to improve. So I'm definitely, you know, call me carnivore adjacent. I don't see the need to do it myself, but I definitely get the power of it. I like organ meats, which apparently freaks everybody out.
What kind of organ meats do you like?
Mainly liver and heart. I tried kidney once, and it does indeed taste like pee, so I've never tried it again. And I actually had haggis once when I went to Scotland when I was in high school and tried haggis, which was foul.
Were you in Edinburgh?
Huh?
Were you in Edinburgh?
I don't remember. May have been. We did go to Edinburgh, but I don't remember where I tried it. We were at a dinner some night, and, you know, in Scotland, obviously, and they said, oh, there's haggis on the menu if you're brave. And I don't know. I might like it more now, because I also didn't like Brussels sprouts at that age. So, you know, who knows?
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe when Paleo Canteen goes international, we can ship some haggis over to you.
I would definitely be willing to try a paleo haggis, because typically it's got a lot of
it's got oatmeal in it, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, pinhead oatmeal. Yeah, and it soaks up the juices. It's a good idea if you're into eating lots of oats with your offal.
Right.
Any tips on cooking organ meat? Because it's something that a lot of people recognize the nutritional value of eating it, but they're just not very fond of trying to cook it, or they don't like the texture or the smell.
See, I'm the wrong person to ask that question, because I've always loved liver. So I don't do any preparation to liver. I just cook it in butter on the, or butter or sometimes bacon grease in the frying pan, and then eat it. Sometimes I'll add, you know, onions and mushrooms to it, but sometimes I'll just eat it straight. So I can't really help people with trying to get over a dislike of liver, because I like it too much.
Yeah. It reminds me of, I don't know if you've ever read about the experiment that they did a long, long time ago, where they got lots of babies and gave them a selection of foods in front of them in little dishes, and they varied where the dishes were laid out in front of the babies. So
wait, you're missing a point. This was an orphanage, and the children were all malnourished.
Yeah. So that definitely adds an emphasis on them picking foods that would be quote unquote right for them at the time if they were malnourished.
Right. So. Right, so.
And what they found was that there was an incredible variety in what the children really, you know, craved and went for, right? So different children had different preferences. And to me, that says that, you know, we talk about trying to choke down organ meats because they're meant to be good for us. But I think we're quite well attuned to, if we're eating a broadly healthy diet, we're quite well attuned to what our body needs.
Right. Now, the one other part about that story that's key is that a lot of those kids had overt nutritional deficiencies. And every single one of them, without any instruction from the adults, picked the foods to cure their nutritional deficiencies. Mm. So there was a kid with rickets, right, which is cured at the time by cod liver oil. Mm. And this kid sat there and ate cod liver oil until his rickets were cured and then never touched it again.
That's remarkable.
Which story resonated with me because, as I said, I had a bunch of bone breaks over that period when I was really happy. And I tried getting cod liver oil and I got the kind, I didn't get it in capsules. I just got a, you know, like a jar of it where I had to eat it with a spoon. Mm-hmm. And for probably 6 or 8 months, I could not go to bed at night without my cod liver oil, eating it with a spoon. It was the best tasting stuff. And then all of a sudden one day I just lost interest with it and I've never had it since. Right. And I've also not broken a bone since. And trust me, I try.
Yeah. You hear about these mountain goats who risk life and limb to get to particular caves where they lick the walls because there's salts there.
Yeah.
And I think it's just the same. We've got very sensitive sensors that we don't consciously understand, and we respond very well to them. I guess what sends us haywire is the modern food environment, where we have certain things going on, like ingredients that make food so palatable that they drive us to overeat. And if not palatable, then chemically rewired to overeat. And that's something you talk about with seed oils, is that it activates the cannabinoid pathway, gives you the munchies, and causes you to overeat.
Right. So and that's a great point to go back to my initial experience when I stopped eating seed oils and I lost my interest in eating carbohydrates. In animal experiments, the fat in seed oils, it's called linoleic acid. And linoleic acid converts through a couple of steps to a chemical called 2-AG in your brain, which is the, it's chemically similar to THC, the, the psychoactive drug in marijuana, right? So a drug drugs typically have some thing in the body, right? Like opium is their endorphins that are chemically similar to it. So opium is acting like it's one of these endorphins.
Yeah.
So THC acts like this 2-AG in the body. If you take a rat and feed him so that he stops eating, and then you inject either THC or 2-AG into their brain, it makes them start eating again, right? So when 2-AG goes up normally in the body, mm-hmm. is when you're fasted. Mm-hmm. So it's a hunger hormone. It tells your body that it doesn't have enough food and it needs to get some food and go eat. Mm-hmm. So even if it's already full and you inject one of these animals, it will start eating again because the trigger has just gone off in its brain saying, hey, you're starving, you need to go eat. Mm-hmm. And they preferentially eat sugar, sweet, and carbohydrates, these rats, when the 2-AG goes off. Mm-hmm. And they've done tests where they have a couple of drugs where they can block the effect of it, and it completely blocks the food craving, and mm-hmm. it's triggered by seed oils, right? When it hits the stomach, it's triggered by seed oils. You don't mm-hmm. even have to digest it. There are receptors in the stomach that are waiting for this, and you know why they exist. I don't know. There are lots of seed oils and seeds, and you know seeds are a good source of energy. So maybe it was a trigger for us to start overeating when we found rich sources of food like nuts and seeds and things.
Yeah.
but it's definitely, you know, there was a human drug that treated that, that affected that pathway and blocked 2-AG's effect, that was released to treat obesity. Unfortunately, it also had the side effect of causing people to kill themselves. So it got pulled off the market pretty quickly.
Wow. Yeah.
But in animals, it's like, you know, if you're a rat in a cage with no noose hanging around, so you can't hang yourself, it's like a miracle drug. It cures every aspect of obesity.
And I think that's an amazing result. And I think it brings out something that comes up a lot, which is that, and I think it's really important that you mentioned the human drug trial, because a lot of people, you know, look at rat or mice trials and say, understandably, yeah, but that's just in mice, so that's just in rats. There's even a spoof Twitter account that's come up that bots the Twitter sphere, and if anyone makes a claim about a story, they subtweet it saying in mice, not in rats.
Right.
It's an important distinction to make, but you can take mice and rat studies almost at face value to be applicable to humans sometimes, if it's a mechanism, and I'm just totally geeking out here, that if it's a mechanism that is shared between humans and mice, right? So right. Sometimes you can say, look, this mechanism in a cell goes back far enough in our shared evolution that it works the same way in both creatures.
Hmm. Right. Yeah, and this seems to be one of those cases, as evidenced by the fact that we already had a human drug to treat that exact pathway.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's a key, because, you know, the biggest change in the human diet over the last 100 years has been the increase in seed oils. There's not been anything else that's happened that's got the, you know, I mean, soybean oil consumption in the United States is up like 1,000-fold over the last 120 years.
Yeah. And even if you don't trust the collection data, you can look at how much is actually in people's fat tissues, and it's gone
right
through the roof, really.
Which study, by the way, was actually done by Stefan Guyanet after he got his PhD.
Right.
Right. He kept looking into that stuff, although, yeah. Yeah, so we know that's been a huge change, and we have pretty clear mechanistic pathways for a lot of the, so for instance, if you take people, there's a couple of studies where they take people on a high carb diet and they give them low seed oils at the same time that they're on high carbs, and their insulin resistance goes away and their fatty liver disease goes away and their weight goes down, right? Yeah. But they're on a high carb diet. So yeah. I think it's a big, you know, I think if you've got metabolic syndrome or obesity, the fastest way to fix it is to go on a low carb keto diet, you know, and low seed oils too.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's what's caused it, because there are people like the, you know, the Japanese who used to eat 80% carbohydrates or close to 80%.
Yeah.
And, you know, even today they're the leanest industrial population on earth.
Yeah. And other isolated populations who eat high starch diets and seem to be in excellent health.
Right. A high starch diet is plan B for human nutrition, because you tend to get stunting and
rotten teeth.
Yeah, not well, it depends on the starch. Rice isn't so bad.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on how sticky the starch is, actually, because if it sticks to your teeth, then the bacteria can use it to dissolve your teeth away.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you do get more cavities. I mean, that was the thing. One of the surprising things I found in Weston Price's book is that most of these people, you know, unlike say Paleolithic people who had near zero cavity rates, most of the people he looked at who were agriculturalists had, you know, 1% cavity rates,
yep.
2%, something like that, really low compared to what he saw in the United States. But still a heck of a lot better. I mean, you know, the rate of periodontal disease in the United States is something like 70%.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the cavity rate is probably 50%. So to be able to get that down to 1 or 2%, you know, I mean, what a win.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, I mean, your sort of your main thesis is about seed oils being the primary driver here. And I've seen some of your critics say that it's more complicated than that. And I think they're saying something which is glib, because of course it's more complicated. Of course there's many factors going into this. But I think what, if I'm representing you right, is you're saying is you've got a sort of Pareto thing going on where you can look at 20% of the cause for 80% of the effect, and you at least getting that from seed oils.
Well, it's not even a Pareto effect, which, you know, for the listeners is basically the low hanging fruit, right? If you want to fix a problem, fix the obvious problems first.
Yeah.
Fix the thing that's causing 80% first, and then, you know, worry about the thing that's fixing the causing the 20% later.
Yeah.
This is more of a, okay, so the folks who critique me on that typically say, well, it's multifactorial. You can't say it's just this one thing. And my rebuttal is, we have not only every human population around the planet, but all of the animal populations that eat human food around us are all having the same suite of problems, right? Hmm. Raccoons in Toronto are getting obese, right? Raccoons in Toronto are not getting obese because they're not counting calories. Rats in New York City, pigeons in New York City are not getting fat because they are calories versus their wild buddies aren't getting fat. It's only the ones eating human food.
And the wild, right? The wild animals don't have treadmills.
Right, right.
Yeah, so exercise
you,
thing.
You know, I was having a conversation with one guy who's a PhD in nutrition, and he said, well, you know, it's pollution. And I said, okay, great, it's pollution. So how long will it take me to debunk that? Oh, the fattest place on Earth is an island in the middle of the South Pacific. They have virtually no pollution, and they're the fattest people on Earth. So
Tonga,
how is it
by any chance?
Huh?
The Tonga by any chance?
Could be Tonga. I don't remember. But, you know, there's a lot of islands in the South Pacific.
Yeah, true. The
fattest people on Earth, I'm pretty sure that will come up, or the Pima, you know. So you can go through all these supposed other factors and pretty easily say, okay, it doesn't apply to these people. It doesn't apply to these people. So then you have to look at, you know, and Weston Price did this, you know, 190 years ago. And he came up with a list of foods that were introduced into all these areas that resulted in disease.
Yeah.
And seed oils was one of them, right? Vegetable fats, he called it, if you want to look it up in his book, right? Now, what's interesting about, you know, when it comes to a some folks posit that, you know, ground starch is what caused the obesity epidemic. Okay, fine. So ground starch was invented, you know, modern flour milling was invented in Europe in the 1600s, right? And became a huge thing in the United States back in the late 1700s, 1800s. Mm-hmm. So why did we wait 140 years later for all of these diseases to become epidemic, right? Mm-hmm. Why did the obesity epidemic not start until the low-fat recommendations became a big thing in the United States? You know, it's just, you can, this is the only thing that I've found that fits all the data.
I'm pretty sure I might have had a conversation with this about you on Twitter before, but what's your take on the caloric availability? You know, was there a glut of, you know, could you get as much bread as you wanted in 17th century Europe? Or, you know, was it, you only really, there's only really enough to feed people on a subsistence, no more, so that maybe if they had eaten enough of it, if there was enough of it around, they could have got fat on it.
Well, there's two ways to answer that. You know, America is the one answer to that. I mean, so many Europeans, you know, the Irish moved to America because there was food here.
Yeah.
Right. We didn't have, you know, obesity was a rare thing in the United States 100 years ago and before then. Mm. Right. Observers came over and they commented on how fit and tall Americans were compared to Europeans because we had better food. Mm-hmm. Or you can, you know, look at a place like Japan where malnutrition was an issue. Mm-hmm. And they did have an inferior diet, you know, 70-80% rice. So you would expect, okay, if this diet with sufficient calories is going to cause obesity, then the upper class should be fat, but they're not.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, you know, there have been lots of, you know, or good heavens. I mean, you know, if caloric sufficiency, I think the French eat something, the French eat more calories than almost any other population on earth from some of the data that I've seen, like 3,700 calories a day. And while they are starting to get a little bit fat as they're adapting American fast food, they're still a fairly thin population. I mean, if you're an American and you go to Europe, the first thing you notice is everybody's skinny.
Yeah.
Compared to over here.
Yeah. You know,
it's crazy how bad it's gotten over here. You know, and the French aren't starving. Yeah. They're famous for rich meals, right?
Oh, yeah. Duck cassoulet.
So, you know, the calorie argument just doesn't hold up.
No.
And
no.
It's like, you know, so another experiment that I ran, I bought this dog, a Norwegian Elkhound. And when I got the dog, everything I read online said that the breed's prone to obesity. And the breeder I bought the dog from, who was arguably the best dog breeder of any breed in the United States, judging by how many wins her dogs have had, you know, she was in her 80s at this point, and she'd been breeding this single breed of dog since she was 13 years old. She told me they were prone to obesity. Oh, you got to really watch the calories, right? You got to really. So I got him right around the time that I went paleo, and I started reading, as one does when one fixes their diet, you start reading ingredients. And I started reading the ingredients on the dog food, and they were horrible. So I decided, well, you know, I'm going to make the dog go paleo too. So did the dog in the breed prone to obesity, what happened to him? I fed him meat and table scraps, which were paleo because the house was paleo.
Yeah.
Never put on a pound. Never. He did get fat at one point when we started buying a processed food, and it turned out it had a lot of chicken fat in it.
Mm.
And he put on a layer of fat, and then we stopped feeding it to him and it went away. But, and he would walk away. He would leave food on the plate.
Mm-hmm.
And walk away when he was full. He would just, you know.
A well-regulated appetite at that point. And
exactly.
Do you use the phrase in America, fit as a butcher's dog?
Fit as a butcher's dog. No, I like that.
Yes. It's, if you see someone who's lean, healthy, strapping, you could say they're fit as a butcher's dog.
Right.
And it's
eating a species appropriate diet.
Well, exactly. Yeah. It's kind of, it's a really old phrase. And I guess it just sort of goes by because most people feed their dogs the same kind of swill. But I read somewhere that you don't see as many Irish setters around now. And the explanation that I saw was that they're particularly prone to celiac or whatever the dog equivalent is. I don't know if they call it celiac in dogs. In the 80s or early 90s, they changed most of the big dog food manufacturers changed the base grain from corn to wheat. And that just caused a decline in the health of the populations of Irish setters. So they just don't breed well now.
Interesting. No, I hadn't heard that. I'm not surprised to hear that because, yeah, my dog, he would, we did find out that there was the health problem this breed has is the wax glands in the skin. They would get these cysts. I forget what they're called now. And we did hear that, you know, feeding him more chicken fat and more chicken would tend to make it worse, which is sort of like the same thing you see in human acne.
Mm.
If you look at what's going on in human acne, it seems to be that the fats and seed oils provide food for the bacteria, right? Just like seed oils cause dysbiosis in people's guts, seems to cause dysbiosis in their skins.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are lots of accounts of people going on a paleo diet or a carnivore diet and their acne clears up.
Yep.
And from what I've looked, that seems to be part of the mechanism. It's got to be carbohydrates as well. Because people don't realize this. And this is one of the crazier things about the medical profession is, you know, diabetics are prone to infections. And they tend to get infections of bacteria that eat glucose.
Mm.
So yes, if you are a rich source of glucose, the bacteria are going to try and eat you. They're not stupid. Right? You're like a walking candy bar for them. So do they try and lower their, you know, and there's lots of evidence in the literature you read about, you know, high blood glucose leads to higher infection rates and hyperglycemia leads to worse outcomes in the hospital. So do they turn around and say, well, the easiest way to get the blood sugar down is stop feeding it to them? No, they keep feeding it to them and they give them insulin, which puts them, you know, on the insulin roller coaster we're all so familiar with.
Yes.
And hopefully gotten off it.
It's dreadful, really. I mean, to my mind, the evidence that it's a species appropriate diet, the sort of paleo, low carb style diet, is cut and dry. To a lot of people, I think they buy the logic and the evidence, but you know, they find it hard to give up eating rubbish food, which you can understand, it's very addictive. But there's another kind of group of people who wouldn't want to go on that sort of diet because they think that the health of the planet might suffer. And it's not, I don't think it's something I've seen you talk about very much, but it'd be interesting to know what you think about whether there's, you know, a conflict between human health and a species appropriate diet and the health of the planet.
Yeah, I don't talk about that too much because it's kind of depressing. I went back and I read Thomas Malthus's book a couple of years ago. So he's the, someone has an unfair reputation. If you actually go back and read the book, it's pretty moderate. And he was a preacher. I think he was a Presbyterian. I'm not sure. It is rather amusing when you're reading through this book because he was also an economist and pretty well regarded at the time. It's amusing when you're reading through his book and he mentions that, you know, well, since the earth was created only 5,700 years ago or whatever it says, you know, you're just like, whoa. But his point was basically that, you know, we overeat our food supply. And he got a bad rap because of what a lot of people wanted to do in his name, you know, eugenics and, you know, population control, which is all fair that those folks got a bad rap because they generally didn't have great intentions. But what he wrote was pretty uneventful. But then you get in, so you get into the paleo diet stuff, as I have, and you start doing research. And I mean, Malthus was right. It's like an indisputable, his state, the all of human history, going back to when we came down out of the trees, was driven by us running out of one food supply and needing to find something else.
Yeah.
Right. When we lived in the trees, we mostly ate fruit and a little meat, probably like chimpanzees do, you know, and leaves and
a
little bit of tubers. And then we came down from the trees for whatever reason. And we went through a period where it seems we really depended on tubers and starch because our back molars grew bigger than chimpanzees are. Mm-hmm. We probably, you know, chimpanzees can use tools to dig up tubers. So we probably got in the habit of walking around digging up tubers and relying on that as a food source.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I don't know why we would have shifted away from tubers to meat. Maybe it was just good sense. But then, you know, we started shifting our food again over to meat. Then we started running out of animals to eat and we had to travel around the world. And if you look at Africa, all the animals in Africa, you know, a lot of the big megafauna went extinct. And then around the edges of Africa, there start appearing shell middens. Mm. Right? Shell midden is where humans went and started eating shellfish. And, you know, if you're a person, you got to eat, you know, like me when I was a kid, I could eat 3 dozen clams on a half shell, no problem. Yeah. That's a lot of clam shells. So the shell middens are these big piles of shells near human habitations. And you can date those. So the shell middens started appearing like 10, 15,000 years ago. So we ran out of food again. That's also when we invented agriculture, right? So the entire human history is a confirmation of Malthus, right? Us running out of food and figuring out the next thing to eat. That's what seed oils are, right?
Yep.
We ran out of butter and animal fats and some bright guy figured out how to detoxify cottonseed oil. And then some bright German guy figured out how to hydrogenate it to make it saturated, right? Yep. that's where seed oils came from. It was because we didn't have enough animal fats. So my short answer to that is what we're doing is definitely unsustainable. Monocrop vegetarian agriculture is going to go down the wrong direction because it, you know, I've been a conservationist. I don't like to use the term environmentalist because I think a lot of environmentalists put the environments over people. I am firmly in the camp of, you know, we need to manage the planet for our benefit.
Yep.
But that means you have to be a conservationist. I mean, I grew up reading about the horrible things that corn and soybean agriculture is doing in the American Midwest, right? We're basically flushing our soil into the Gulf Stream.
Yeah, well, I mean, we know over here, we know it's called the Dust Bowl.
Well, the Dust Bowl was a different, that was a drought.
Okay. Right?
But I mean,
thought that was, I thought it was a result of taking the buffalo off the plains.
Well, that, I mean, yeah. Why we killed all the buffalo because we couldn't defeat the Indians when they were eating a high buffalo diet. So we killed off their food source.
I mean, yeah, that tells you something in itself.
Huh?
That tells you something in itself about the quality of it as a food source.
Oh, yeah. And then we put the Indians on, oh, I have a couple of fantastic books about the Indians. And, you know, then we put them on reservations and what do we feed them? Wheat flour, sugar, and lard cut with cottonseed oil.
Mm-hmm.
And what did their health do? It went in the toilet.
Mm-hmm.
Like every other group that you do that with, right? So, you know, yeah, if you want multifactorial, there are your three factors. Sugar, wheat, seed oils. Stop eating those three and your nutrition will go through the roof. So, yeah, I think, you know, Savory, I think he's the only guy I've ever heard of who's actually addressing the problem, which is a soil management issue, right?
Yeah.
If you want sustainable food, you need to recreate a natural ecosystem that builds up soil.
Yeah. Right?
And you need to figure out a way to get people's poop back on the field so that you're recycling nutrients and how to get nutrients out of the ocean and back up onto, you know, the high plains where we're growing corn, you know? So yeah, but you know, the notion, all that a vegan diet would do is what it's already doing. There are 2 billion people on earth who are eating a plant-based diet and they are all malnourished. They have iron deficiency, they have zinc deficiency, they have vitamin A deficiency, all of which are nutrients that are easily found in meat.
Yeah. Right?
So if you put us all on a vegan diet, you'll wind up with a planet that is going to be too sick to fix our problems.
And we'll still need the calories ultimately, and we'll still reproduce and need more calories. So it's a bit of a circular argument either way you look at it. You retweeted an article recently by an Indian writer who wrote about Indian vegetarianism, which was really interesting, and how, in her opinion, as an Indian, seeing it from the inside, it's less to do with caring for animals, vegetarianism in India, and more to do with establishing caste dominance, and that the higher castes who impose vegetarianism culturally on poorer people, they've got enough nutrition by having access to ghee and eggs and paneer, but how it translates to the poorer castes is they have to eat grains all the time, and so they're really desperately deficient.
Oh yeah, well, malnutrition is a huge problem. I don't know. I'm sure she's right, just because it's human nature that people will use, you know, stuff like that to establish dominance hierarchies. There is a genuine, you know, I shared an office with a Jain, which is the only, as far as I know, long-term vegetarian population on Earth. And he explained to me why Jains are vegetarian. It was fascinating because, you know, I've never met anybody who knew more about the shortcomings of a vegetarian diet than this Jain. Because I started saying, you know, oh, it's not healthy. And he's like, oh, we know that. And here's how it's unhealthy. And here's what we have to eat to make it healthy. And this is why we do it. And, you know, they have this concept of ahimsa, which means without harm, right? Because if you're a Jain, you not only are protecting animals, right? So they won't kill an animal, but mm-hmm. they'll eat its milk because that's not its life.
Yep.
But they won't like eat a potato, because to dig up a potato is to kill the potato plant.
Wow.
Right. So they're very logical. The Jains are incredibly logical.
Yeah, it's consistent. Yeah.
Aware about what they're doing, mm-hmm. and they've been at it for thousands of years. So they're obviously, you know, they're doing something right.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely that, and I respect that. I don't agree with them, but I respect that opinion and thoughtfulness. So I think there's definitely there's an element of truth to what she said. I wouldn't entirely discount their notion of care, because I think it's a deep religious view that they have.
Sure.
And it's actually my best friend is Indian. We grew up together, and I've had lots of conversations at the holidays over at his house with his father. His mother's American, his father's Indian, about stuff like this. And I explained my theory about why the cow is sacred in India. And I said, okay, so let's think about it. We've got a village. They're basically relying on dairy, right? Like Jains, for instance, eat dairy because they've recognized that it's required for their health. So then you have some knucklehead who kills the last cow in the village. Well, now you have a village of vegans with no B12 supplements.
Mm-hmm.
Oops. They're all going to get sick, and they're all going to think to themselves, oh my God, we've killed the cow, and now God is punishing us by giving us all these horrible diseases. Let's get another cow and not kill this one.
Yeah.
Bingo, sacred cows for a good biological reason.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true, but my friend's dad, he was like, yeah, that makes sense. He's Hindi, so, you know, it was plausible to him at least.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been over there and, you know, the cows are walking down the road, and
yeah.
you have traffic jams that last for hours because there's a cow in the road, and you don't want to interfere with it meandering along because you'll get mobbed.
Or mauled. Cows are mean.
Yeah, true. Yeah, you don't want to get too close to them. You got any more questions, John?
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about your running.
Oh, there we go.
Well, so I was curious about when you changed your diet off the back of your health problems. What kind of impact did that have on your fitness regime?
Yeah, great question. So I got into running seriously. I tried to run for a bunch of years, and I'd sort of noticed over the years that I did better running with minimalist shoes. I mean, I was running in sandals probably 17, 18 years ago, you know, before the whole minimalist shoe thing became a big thing. Just because a bunch of, you know, anyway, without going all the way back, but I never really had a lot of commitment to it because I didn't, you know, I hadn't really thought it through. And I bought by dumb luck a pair of minimalist trail racing flats once, and that was like the best year of running I ever had, because I would get shin splints, horrible shin splints when I was running, so I couldn't run consistently and I couldn't really run on the road for any distance. So when I got the diverticulitis and I started doing research into it, the only thing that was negatively associated with diverticulitis was running. So as I joked, so I like to joke, I was running from a man with a knife, right? Mm. The surgeon who had told me that, you know, I was probably going to have surgery in 6 months if I couldn't make it go away. So that was my attempt to make it go away. And luckily I came to, you know, I fell in love with running. And then when I changed my diet, I went from high carb to keto almost immediately. You know, I used to ski. God, I used to, the first half marathon I ran, I bonked at like mile 10, which tells you how carb dependent I was.
Yeah.
And I used to, you know, I would go out skiing and I would go out for a few runs until I was basically shaking and exhausted. And I would come in and I would have some plate of fries or whatever for energy, and then go back out and ski a couple of runs until I was shaking and exhausted. you know, and just that was the cycle through the day, and didn't do me any good, obviously. When I switched, I would go, I was pretty quickly able to go all day on coffee and half and half. And at the same time, I discovered heart rate training. So I learned to modulate myself, right? To slow down, to go faster. And, oh, I got so much faster. You know, I could do runs top to bottom where I'd, you know, I'd never had the energy to make it all the way down. I'd have to stop and recover. And now I, you know, would just hammer it all the way down. Mm-hmm. Even that's... now, I mean, I'm 13 years older and I'm, you know, there's an old joke by a sage of skiing. If you're a better skier at 40 than you were at 20, then you weren't a very good skier when you were 20. That's definitely true for me, but you know what? I'll just take it that I'm a much better skier now than I was 13 years ago. And then for running, same thing. I mean, last summer I did a run on the Appalachian Trail that was a 20-mile loop. And first time I tried to do it, I brought some food along and, you know, that didn't work all that well. The stuff was too salty. It was a mess. I was trying beef jerky and pemmican at the time. And, you know, it was like a 7-hour run over these mountains and then back along this road. And I did it last summer, brought no food, just a water bottle, did it in 5 hours, piece of cake. Uh-huh. I remember the loop is actually 19 and a half miles, right? So the first time I did it, I was like, okay, I'll just do a little extra at the end and I'll get my 20 miles in. And when I got to the car, there was no way I could go that extra half a mile. No way. And this time I missed the car. I ran past, you know, felt fine. It was not even a big deal. So yeah, fitness. I read about a guy, Killian Jornet, who, he reset my notion of what training should be like. He recently went up and down. He's an interesting guy. He's on a high carb diet, but he trains fasted. And he recently went up and down Mount Everest. I think it took him 26 hours round trip.
Whoa.
No food.
No way.
He brought a couple of goos along and a water bottle. He did Mount Denali in Alaska. He's knocked, if I remember correctly, 5 hours off the existing record on a goo and a half a liter of water over 15 hours.
Wow.
So when I heard about that, I was like, okay, no more food on runs.
My girlfriend ran the Liverpool Marathon a couple of years ago, fasted. We had steak dinner the night before, and then she ran it. She started getting kind of muscular pain around mile 20, but that was just mechanical. She wasn't well. She hadn't done strength training enough. Yeah, so I think some people thought that was silly, but she obviously never lost energy. Really interesting.
Oh yeah, it's been night and day. I mean, it's you know, in hindsight, it's such a no-brainer. I mean, the folks I run with, they're like, but why do you want to make it harder for yourself? And I'm like, I'm not making it harder for myself. It's faster. Yeah.
And that method that you mentioned, is it fair to call it the Maffetone method? You train your fat burning machinery, if you like, to you get a heart rate monitor and you find the number, which is roughly 180 minus your age. Then you set the heart rate monitor to give an alarm off if you go out with that plus or minus sort of 5 beats per minute or so.
Right.
And then you just run to that heart rate, and that trains your fat burning mechanism so that over time, and it is slow apparently, you get faster and faster.
Right, you get faster at the same heart rate.
Yeah,
you build up your fat burning capacity, your heart rate comes down. I mean, I'm substantially faster. I actually have trouble getting my heart rate up as much as I used to be able to now, but I'm going a lot faster. Yeah, it's been, you know, it's good. It is miserable though. I have a post on my blog, the 7 phases of heart rate training, and one of them, you know, and I think the first one is I forget what I called it, but the point of it is it's miserable at the beginning, and if you're doing it right, it will be miserable. Because you will. I remember one run, I was running along this road near here that's a flat road on a hot summer day, and when I got into the sun, my heart rate would go up, and mm-hmm. I would have to slow down and walk. And then when I got into the shade, my heart rate would go back down and I could start running again. I was so pissed off. It was torture. But now, so you walk up hills and you get to the point where you're just running up hills. And then you get to the point where your heart rate monitor goes off and you realize it's because you're running too slowly up the hill.
Wow.
And you've got to pick up the pace, right? And then
you're just churning through that fat, just like, fatty acids just getting rattled through.
Yeah, well, it's like, that 5-hour, that 5-hour run I did, I think I had something, I did something more recent. I went out with my running group to do this little mountain over near the Hudson River in New York State. And, all these people are sugar burners, and we go over there and I'm flying along. We get down to the end. They're like, we can't go any further. We can't keep up with you. We got to go get something to eat. And, we go to lunch and I'm just like, yeah, I didn't have breakfast. I didn't have dinner last night either. And they're all like, what is wrong with you? Nothing wrong with me. There's something wrong with you. If I'm 25 years older than you and I can kick your butt, I'm not the one who's doing something wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've taken a lot of your time, and it's been really, really interesting. I really appreciate you coming on and talking to us.
It's been a great conversation. Thanks, guys, for having me on.
Yeah, sure. And I was excited to talk to you sort of in person, having seen you go on that journey on Twitter. And
yeah,
I'm looking forward to the future, where I think in the near enough future there'll be a critical mass of people who understand all of these things and will be able to make themselves better.
Well, we're real close. I mean, certainly popularly we're real close, because people are using when I was on a keto diet almost 10 years ago, everybody thought I was a lunatic. I remember when I asked Phil Maffetone about it. I went to meet him at a talk and I said, so what do you think about the keto diet? And he was like, I don't know anything about it. He says, I had one woman who was on it once and she had the fastest improvement I've ever seen, but that's my entire experience. And, now he's doing podcasts about the keto diet.
Mm-hmm.
And, you meet random people and you mention keto and they're like, oh yeah, the keto diet. I've heard about that. My friend lost all this weight on it, Whereas 10 years ago, it was like, oh, everybody thought it was insane, the notion. Yeah. I remember an argument I got into online where somebody was like, you need to go read Tim Noakes' The Lure of Running. He has a whole chapter on the necessity of carbohydrates.
he's not exactly kept up with Tim Noakes' publication since then.
Yeah, he came around.
But he's actually coming on the podcast. We've got him. We're interviewing Tim Noakes next week.
That's great. That'll be a lot of fun, I'm sure. But yeah, it's been awesome, guys. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, thanks again.
Thanks again. And just let everyone know where they can find you online, if not in person.
Oh, I'm on Twitter. My handle is Tucker Goodrich. My name, TuckerGoodrich. And my blog is Yelling Stop, which is yelling-stop.blogspot.com. The easiest way to find it is there's a link to it in my Twitter profile.
Fantastic.
9-10 years of posts on there, like several thousand posts on various topics.
Mm-hmm. I read a lot of them. Very interesting. I came to you through the Hyperlipid blog about you popped up in the comments a lot on Hyperlipid, and that's how I started reading your blog. Thanks for all of the digging you've done and for your time today.
It's been a pleasure, guys. Thank you very much.
All right.
Cheers, Tucker. Bye.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. Paleocanteen.co.uk is the UK's one-stop paleo and low-carb food provider, where you can get restaurant-quality meals, grass-fed Scottish beef and lamb, outdoor-bred pork, and a selection of paleo and low-carb products delivered chilled to your door. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Use the code CANTEEN15, that's CANTEEN15, to get 15% off your first order. Thanks, see you next time.